Welcome to episode 476. Are you trying to make a baby, which is, you know, the fun part, but you're actually having fertility issues? Infertility numbers are at unprecedented levels, and in the modern world, you'd think that this shouldn't be a problem with all the technology and medicine that we have available. But as it turns out, you shouldn't really need technology and medicine to have your body do what it was designed to do. And on today's episode, I talk with a medical doctor that is an expert in sleep, gut health, and vitamin D about how to fix your fertility issues naturally and get on with making as many mini-me's as you want. We also talk about sleep issues in babies and, for the most part, that it can actually be a simple solution to get newborn babies and toddlers sleeping well. And no, I'm not talking about sleep training. This is one of those episodes that is so packed with knowledge that you might need to take notes and probably listen twice. So, let's get into it. Even as a scientist and nutritionist, I was secretly trapped in binge eating and hooked on sugar. And let's be real, the so-called solutions can feel overwhelming. Calorie counting, restrictive diets, weight loss pills, surgery, and even injections. I'm Maddie Lansdowne, and the truth is, more nutrition facts aren't the answer. It's understanding why we eat the way we do. And you don't need to be perfect to achieve great health either. That shift changed everything for me. And now I share it here as the host of the Real Weight Loss Coach podcast, where it's my mission to help 1 million people break free from the yo-yo diet cycle for good by bringing you the conversations that really matter in nutrition, health, and psychology. And I'm not afraid to challenge mainstream health advice when it doesn't stack up. Are you ready? Let's begin. What's up, my healthy friends? Here we are on the How to Not Get Sick and Die podcast. And if you're new here, or even if you've been around a little while, you'll know that this year it's my mission to support 500 people to achieve real weight loss. And by real, I mean dealing with what's really weighing you down and not just the number on the scale. So to find out if you're a good fit for our programs or just to make an inquiry, there is a link down in the show notes in the caption below. Scroll down, click the link. Let's have a chat. Okay, today we have one of my favorite guests back on the show. She was previously on episode 301, 303, and 365, and now today's. So after today's, go back and listen to those because they're amazing episodes. We've got Stasha Gomanak, the expert on all things sleep. She's a bit of a renegade medical doctor, and further to that, a neurologist that's going against the grain on some of these sleep topics, which I like because a lot of the conventional advice that we get in many aspects of medicine and health isn't really cutting the mustard, so to speak. Some years after publishing some extremely pivotal research that challenged the mainstream narrative on sleep disorders, she created the program called The Right Sleep Coach, where she now helps people with all types of diseases and disorders to heal their bodies by optimizing their sleep. Stasha, welcome back to the show. How are you?
Good. Thanks for asking me to come back, Maddie.
Oh, I always love our conversations. And you're such a passionate person and such a well-researched person, and those two things combined make for fantastic podcasts.
I'm glad.
And we're both in this interesting chapter where we both have little children around, and so sleep is a very pertinent topic for us to be discussing. I've got a newborn in the house, and you've got a new grandchild, which is really exciting. So congratulations.
Thank you, and congratulations to you, Maddie, as well.
Yeah. So I guess today, on topic, we're going to get into these conversations around how sleep affects, you know, the pregnant body, the mum's body, the new parent's body, all of that kind of stuff. And I guess, more importantly, what consequences that flows onto later in life. So I guess, where do you want to start? Because there's so many big topics there.
I first want to start to review very briefly what we talked about in the other podcast, because my approach is very unique and very, very briefly, sort of by accident. And because my patients were willing to come back when things went awry, my patients and I'm a neurologist. My patients and I discovered that there were several deficiency states that were actually making them have sleep disorders, not just insomnia, but sleep apnea and a whole range of sleep disorders. And those deficiencies really started with vitamin D when we moved indoors. But the most important piece to take away is that when the vitamin D goes low, then the microbiome changes. And when the bacterial contents change, they then stop providing us with multiple other cofactors that are extremely important for sleep. So when the bacteria go bad and they become a group of bacteria that don't need vitamin D because we're not able to supply it to them anymore, then they stop supplying us with the 8B vitamins. If you've never thought about this before, there's vitamin A and then eight things called B and then C and D, which is kind of weird when you think about it. And it turns out the reason why there are eight is they are all supplied by bacteria. So think about it in terms of bacteria existed on this planet first. They are the ones that actually determined how to take things like pieces of rock and become a living organism. That's not the way we're looking at it now, but that's really what happened. So they dissolved the rock and used iron out of the rock or selenium out of a rock and incorporated it into a pathway that supplied living energy. Then all of us multicelled organisms came on the planet, and we are so lazy that we just use what they knew how to do already. That means when you lose the normal microbiome, you are not really a normal human. And how you manifest that is dependent a little bit on your genetic makeup, but the most common things that result are problems with sleep and multiple chronic illnesses and things that have become extremely common since the 1980s. And it is not that we lost our microbiome but through the use of antibiotics, okay? It is from having a low D. The way you bring it back is to supply D plus a large dose B complex, B50. Now, that's a very brief summary of most of the things we talked about in the first few podcasts. Now, what we're going to do is talk about why it's so important for women who are trying to get pregnant to know about this, hopefully before they get pregnant, and how vitamin D is a major player in fertility. So the reason why there's been so much infertility, in my view and the view of many other authors, is because vitamin D was actually intentionally, depending on how you look at evolution versus creation, vitamin D ties us to the sun and therefore to the food. We are so divorced from that now that we don't really understand that all the other animals on the planet live outside, and their biology is completely linked to the multiple wavelengths of energy that we receive from sun radiation, not just UVB that makes D. So that means our biology is run by being outside. And what you'd like to be able to do to survive at the far north or far south of our planet is to be able to coordinate your fertility, when your babies will be born, to the time on the planet where you will have food. So you really don't want to give birth to your baby if you're a bird living in the snow when there is no food for the baby, okay? Bears, we know, make a little hole in the ground and have her pups, while her cubs, while she's underground so that she is giving milk to the babies. There are differences with each species, but ultimately, when you picture it through that lens, that means if your D goes low, survival advantage would mean you will not get pregnant. And in fact, there is lots of OBGYN literature now published showing that when the D is low, there's a thing called anti-Müllerian hormone, the secondary hormone, and it inhibits ovulation. That means each egg that's trying to ovulate is inhibited. Now, the fertility experts do know this or should know this. And actually, there are people who are getting this anti-Müllerian factor measured. But in actual fact, all you have to do is get your D over 60, or in Canadian units, Australian units, and British units, that's over 150. It will change your fertility dramatically. There is also a block to male fertility that travels somewhat through D, but mostly through a B vitamin called B5, where they've shown in animal studies if you're B5 deficient, and that comes about because the microbiome is wrong. So D goes low, lose your microbiome. B5 is one of the most important B vitamins, and it's been largely overlooked. But animals that were made B5 deficient don't have normal spermatogenesis. So that means both on the woman and the man's side, they both need to be watching their D and bring back their microbiome in order to have a normal pregnancy. Now, having said all that, let's just say that you haven't heard my podcast until you're already pregnant. The next question is, we've gotten into this place where either the fertility expert or your OBGYN is running the show. There's a trend recently, which I'm really happy about, to increase the amount of B vitamins in the prenatal vitamins. But then the next question would it be safe for me to do Stasha's program, which includes B50, which means all 8 Bs, 50 milligrams or 50 micrograms of each. There are some prenatals that I've had in clients who are in Norway who have actually a few other things in them and higher doses. But in a general sense, what I want to get across is if you start from the assumption that all of us that lived outside when we got pregnant, we are the only source of the B vitamins to our baby. And we do not get the Bs from our food. That is a lie. It was an accident. It was a misinterpretation of certain experiments that were done in the 1940s and 50s. But we really get them from our microbiome. That means if you have a normal microbiome, the entire pregnancy, your supply of the B vitamins are coming from your microbiome, being absorbed into your bloodstream and supplying your baby through the placenta. That means if you just get your microbiome back, you may actually be able to go through your whole pregnancy supplying the normal amount of vitamins to that baby. If you, on the other hand, don't get to do this until you're 3 months along, and hopefully your baby by ultrasound and other measures is completely normal, when you take B50, because your D was quite low and you meet the criteria to need to take that to bring your microbiome back, you're actually duplicating the same amount that your baby would have gotten from your microbiome. And in my program, you take B50 for 3 months and then you stop it. And then the bugs are there supplying the amount of Bs that are necessary. That means it's not as simple as saying, oh, I have a prenatal vitamin. Well, unfortunately, along with doctors just saying that vitamins weren't important to them, they also didn't pay any attention to the fact that before mid-1980s and after 1980s, the actual helpers in mom's belly are gone. And that has made a huge impact in infertility, the percentages of children that are now autistic in features, the percentage of kids who have ADHD, percentage of kids that have autoimmune diseases. Many of these things are related to specific B vitamins that are missing both in utero and in early childhood. So it's safe to do this Right Sleep program, and you can do it while you're pregnant, and you would like to be able to complete it and have a normal microbiome before the pregnancy. It's interesting to note that we know from 60 years ago that most of the important malformations that are physical malformations like cleft lip, cleft palate, meningomyelocele, things that are about joining the two sides of the body very early in development, within the first 5 to 12 weeks, but sometimes before mom even knows she's pregnant, those are related to B vitamin deficiencies. Therefore, you would have thought that somebody even long ago would say, well, where do those Bs come from? We kept saying they're from the food. So if you have a good diet, you shouldn't have any problem. Well, it turns out that's not true. When the doctor said that before the 80s, before anybody became D deficient, most of the time they were probably right because people were living outdoors more and they didn't have the wrong microbiome. But as soon as you start to see IBS and all the other chronic illnesses going up, we can't make the same assumptions. Any comments or questions about that before I babble on?
So many. So I guess early on in your share there, you talked about the fact that the access to vitamin D or having an abundant vitamin D within your body was an indicator that you were near the sun. Therefore, you were near plants that were able to obviously feed you and the baby, right? So, but I'm curious because you said if you get your D above 150 in Australian Canadian units, that you know, you're in a good space in regards to fertility. My question is, when we're taking, you know, synthetic vitamin D supplements versus getting the UV exposure from the sun, is it just the vitamin D in our blood that's important, or is there some other factor that's relevant to actual sun exposure that benefits fertility?
It is absolutely better to be sun exposed. There are many reasons for that. One is, it turns out that the vitamin D that we take orally is being converted. It's going into your stomach and then it's going through the liver. So it's being converted to D25OH. When we make it on our skin, it goes into the blood. And if you're pregnant, it takes the vitamin D without the 25OH and feeds that into the breast milk. So it turns out there are studies that show the only form of D that passes into the breast milk is the D without the 25OH. So their first comment is, metabolically, you're favoring the correct way to give it to your baby by being in the sun. The second comment is that in actual fact, when we're in the sun, there are an array of D types. There's a one author who is doing an incredible job, whose name is Slominski at the University of Alabama, ironically in the dermatology department, who has shown that we have really a rainbow of D types. They have all these different OHs on them and they have multiple different effects. Most of his studies were originally on skin and skin healing. So he was one of the first to show that if your vitamin D is good, you're less likely to get melanoma. That means if you're in the sun, vitamin D prevents the development of melanoma. It also prevents the development of all the other skin cancers. So part of the problem has been, this is a small aside. Part of the problem has been if you pick up someone from Scotland and you drop them in high sun areas of Australia, you've just done something that person's genome that gave them red hair and freckles made them perfectly aligned with Edinburgh, Scotland. But they're not perfectly aligned with huge amounts of very high sun areas. And that means they don't have the natural protection of melanin formation that the Aboriginals in Australia have, okay? That's not so hard to figure out, okay? Now, if you then take that and say, oh, nobody in Australia should be exposed to the sun, you've missed the major point. You have to decide what your risks are versus benefit. And since we can measure a D level from sun exposure, we can actually use sunscreen in an intelligent way to not have our D level be low. Now, it's really good to have sunscreen because it's still important to be outside a lot. And that means in the past, we would have to completely cover our skin with a fabric. Now we can use sunscreen and we can still have exposure to many, many other wavelengths of light. So what we're trying to do at this point is to try to walk a fine line between how old am I? How much skin exposure have I had to damaging rays of the sun, like UVA and UVB, when my D wasn't high enough to protect me and I hadn't yet built a tan, okay? There are multiple protective features that D has. But if I've had 20 years of insufficient D, and what you were talking about in one of our other podcasts about going out in the sun in little bursts instead of spending the whole year out there, then we actually have to do things that are a little bit more calculated. So we might use supplement and change our dose in the summer and use sunscreen, but spend as much time outside as we can while we're doing that. There are several things about those other forms of vitamin D that are just starting to be studied. Like the same guy, Slominski, is measuring these other forms of D. 99% of the literature online says there's vitamin D25OH, which is the storage, and there's vitamin D125OH, which is the active, and that's all I know. There are actually 20, 30 forms of active D, and it's active at things other than the vitamin D receptor, which means there's a complexity to this that is daunting, but if we don't do anything about it, then we have our current state, which is infertility and problems with our baby. So we can see what happens when we rely on the idea that being in the sun is wrong. Okay, we have lots and lots of disease surrounding us where we can say, wait, this wasn't the right thing. Therefore, we have to go in between. If you want to try to undertake making your D level get to 150 by sun exposure, it usually is going to take you several years to figure that out where you live. And you're going to have a job where you can spend the entire day outside, which, unless you're a professional surfer, is a little difficult. Even my clients who were surveyors, let's say, in Texas, it gets so incredibly hot in the summer that people don't stand out in the sun when it's 110 degrees. So that's a really good question. And there's so much left to learn about it that I feel like we're doing the best we can with supplementation, but we should never forget that biohacking always has a downside.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's a huge movement of the biohacking that's been going on for a few years now. But I guess probably oversimplify. So from a fertility standpoint, the idea is that the fact that we're all inside and heavily clothed is resulting in low vitamin D, which is signaling to a woman's body that there's low food resources around, and therefore having a child would be a really bad idea because there's already not enough food around. So fertility is dropping because of a lack of exposure to sunlight, vitamin D, which would tell us there is lots of food.
Correct.
Got it. What happened in 1980? Because you referenced before and after 1980.
Okay, the reason why I know this, as I was alive then, we started to use sunscreen in the middle 80s. And we also have a convergence of air conditioning and then computers. So the great, and for instance, let's take somebody who lives in India or lives in Mexico, and their skin type is really set up to be closer to the equator. And then they get educated, and especially in women, then they get a college education and they become a professional. They are not digging in the dirt. They are not carrying their baby on their back. There are multiple articles about how you can actually prove this from a population standpoint. One of them comes out of COVID. And I'll give you another one that's 100 years ago that's even more upsetting. But COVID, when you look at what happened in India, that the highly educated professionals got worse outcomes from catching COVID than the most poor dirt farmers. They both caught COVID, but the outcome for death and serious illness was higher in those who live indoors. Mm-hmm. There's another really interesting article from 1925 from Mass General, where a guy is talking about rickets, which is the historical name of vitamin D deficiency before the actual vitamin was chemically purified, et cetera. And he talks about how rickets as a disease, as a syndrome at the time, was first described in Northern Europe and then described in the US and also described in Australia. But there's another story that's interesting in India, where those who are still having their babies at home, putting their babies on their back and going out and digging in the dirt, so the lower castes of India didn't have an incidence of rickets. It wasn't reported. The higher castes that stayed inside and committed their women to what was called purdha, where they weren't allowed to go outside, not only in their children, but also osteoporosis in their women. So this has been known for over 100 years. Yet, because of weird things that are happening in medicine that are not, I'm not paranoid. So I try not to think that anybody has, I prefer to think that things arise in medicine because we are conservative, because we are not very imaginative, because medicine selects for the followers, not the entrepreneurs and the think outside the box people. And really, since COVID, there's been a big political hubbub about vitamin D. And the word vitamin has now been treated as though you must be crazy if you're going to talk about that. And I really felt that as a clinician now almost 15 years ago when I first started talking about it. I fell into the fact that there was good science showing that vitamin D was running our sleep and that was had been reported in the 80s. I really started to get a lot of blowback from my colleagues. So the odd part about this is not only should we be outside or should we take supplements, it's also how medicine has reacted so negatively and pushed back about this supplementation. And I'll stop there and let's see if you have any comments.
So many, especially having been through, I guess, the witnessing the birthing process. Because we, Yali, you know, as you know, we had Bub at home in the lounge room. And one of my priorities regularly is to make sure that he touches grass and is lying on the bare earth, you know, for that exposure to microbiome diversity and breathing different things in and eating random things. But the thing I wanted to ask is because you mentioned that supplemental vitamin D doesn't necessarily make it into the breast milk. And we are now here in Australia, we're in winter and Yali's got dark colored skin. So that feels like multiple layers of vitamin D not making it into the breast milk.
Yes. And in actual fact, there are very few. There's a guy named Bruce Hollis, who is a PhD chemist, who worked with another person named Carol Wagner. And those two, I believe out of South Carolina or North Carolina, are the only ones that have really done case-controlled trials where they're watching the D level instead of just giving a fixed dose. So what you'd like to know is, well, what dose of D does Yali have to take to actually be able to get some vitamin D in her breast milk? I mean, that seems like a logical question, you know? You're making all these assumptions that each person, you know, we'll just say you have to have this much time outside in the sun. Well, what if I'm feeding my son in the winter? And there, you know, in Melbourne, there isn't any UVB light in this time. How much vitamin D should I take? No one has done those studies. No one has measured in a way that's valuable to say, and you have to do it. You can't do it by testing 100 people and then taking. The mean is not helpful. The mean is only helpful to look like you're doing something in this article. It is not relevant to, oh, there is obviously a bell curve in every single study. And what can we say about this is the dose that Yali needed to get this level of D in the breast milk? Even at the moment, we can't really take a population of women and say, what's the normal amount of D that shows up in the breast milk? Because this population is really not normal.
Yeah, because at the minute we're you know, heavy dosing vitamin D, there's plenty going in because of the reasons just mentioned.
I do have a couple of observations that are relevant and that really go to the next piece, which is if you've done the Right Sleep program during pregnancy, what I have you do is keep your D for Australian units between 150 and 200. Now, some of the practitioners are not freaking out when you come in and you have a D level like that. There are a few that still do, but in keeping it between 150 and 200, so in my units, that's 60 to 80. What I do have is several women who I followed all the way through their pregnancy and through the baby's infancy, where when the mom gives birth and her D level is 60, usually the baby's D level is 40. I don't recommend that we do D levels in babies and toddlers. It's too much of a nightmare. So instead, I recommend we do the mom's D levels and recognize that this claim that the D level needs to be 60 to 80 to have better sleep means that you had to get to a deficiency state where you ruined your body and you ruined your sleep before you ever got interested in this, which to me might mean we really have to overshoot what the normal should be. Because of the supplement industry, we're picturing things as, one, if this is good, twice as much, it must be better, which it's not, absolutely. In hormones, there's always a fixed, level between, and that's a homeostatic level, where there will be many processes that will try to keep it in the same place. That's assuming that our life is always outdoors for our whole life. Mm-hmm. That means when I'm coaching people, we already started from a big deficit. And I don't think it's safe or fair to say we should all try to get to 60. If there's nothing wrong with you, that when we measured hunter-gatherers who don't even have a hut, their mean levels for the whole tribe were in the 40s or the 50s. Now, the next question for someone who's interested in supplements would be, well, I don't want to know what the mean was. That's including 82-year-old grandma and 12-year-old kid. I want to know who's the one who shot the lion and is the hero of the tribe, okay? I want to be at my peak. And they didn't even sort that out. They didn't actually make a connection between physical performance and stamina and lifespan and D levels. Okay, they just give us means. Now, what does that mean? That means we need something in ourselves or in our baby that we can observe that tells us whether or not we're in the right place. Okay, that means if your son is sleeping through the night, and each epoch is a little different, like the first 6 months and feeding every 4 hours is different than the next 6 months. And then the second year is a little different. There are comments that have been recorded and written articles about what the sleep should be like in normal babies, okay? There is a huge literature about getting your kid to sleep. What does that mean? It means most kids are not sleeping very well. Otherwise, you would never put that into the search engine. There are so many people telling you what to do that it makes it quite obvious that sleep disorders in childhood and early infancy are very common. Also, there's a whole dental sleep industry that's showing us that mouth breathing in infants is very, very damaging to the mouth and upper and lower jaw development, as the mouth needs to be closed so the tongue can be telling the brain where everything is, so we can have a nice wide palate, have a nice wide nasal opening so that we can breathe normally while we're paralyzed in deep sleep. So there's lots of literature to suggest that the sleep right now is not normal. That makes it very difficult to go back. And for this course I just gave, I went back and went through all the literature that I could find going back to the 50s and the 60s about childhood sleep. There isn't any. You would think that there would be, but it's really the same thing that we're doing now, which is a nurse practitioner or a nurse or a woman who has observed multiple babies sleeping is really the only expert, that we don't really have good data. And now some of the things that I was really struck by was that if you now look at some recorded actual purposeful sleep studies in babies, and you have a video monitoring, and then you have what's called an actigraphic or a movement sensor, like the Oura Ring or the Fitbit, something that's using movement to judge whether the kid is asleep or awake. The best movement sensors were not very good. They show them sitting up in the bed, and the movement sensor says they're asleep. Well, that kind of leaves you with, well, who should I believe? You know?
Yeah.
So I read a lot of articles about, and now I don't really feel as comfortable saying, oh, your baby should do X. Okay. And now I have a 15-month-old living with us. And I know that she wakes up and cries during the night. And I know that we have to not get up and try to calm her down each time. And I know that most of them get through it okay. But it's frustrating that we don't have better science about it. We don't even have a good normal. Now, having said that, you can still judge whether or not your kid is happy, healthy, feeding well, pooping regularly. And that's better than just saying you have a colicky child, okay? Here's why I'm not an expert. I'm a pitiful offering, because pediatrics still says, oh, Natalie hasn't slept for the last 4 days. Oh, you have a colicky baby. Excuse me? Do you not understand how that destroys a whole family? You know, if you have other kids in the house, it is horrifying. So if that's their only answer, which is pitiful, then I'm going to come up with things that are way less than ideal, but they're still better. They're still, you know, if your baby doesn't sleep, just colicky. Sorry. For 100 years, we've known that vitamin D deficiency led to kids that don't sleep. So let's try a little vitamin D supplementation. I'm not going to have you do the levels the way I did with the mom, but you're going to give them a few drops, and then you're going to give them a baby multivitamin, and then we're going to wait 2 or 3 days, and then we're going to give a little bit more, and then you're going to give a little bit more, and then you're going to watch their sleep instead of following their D level. And you're going to also pay attention to the fact that you don't want to go too high, as the same as you don't want to go too low. So it's not that my answer is simple or can be generalized to every child. It's really, okay, mom is taking D supplement. Is she using any formula? Does the formula have D in it? Make sure it's D3. And then if she's not giving any formula, then give some D drops and do a few things and see what happens. Then pay attention if you transition from breast milk or mom's taking D to formula, that there might be a change there. So you're just looking for, is this external variable changing how my kid sleeps and what mood they're in and how much they nap and how restless they are? There's another piece to this that's starting to come out in the sleep studies. I have another colleague who works in Mexico City who helps with infants, and iron supplementation in infants drastically changes their sleep right away in a day, which suggests that the women who are D deficient, who have lost their microbiome, frequently have trouble with their iron levels. And it's because those bacteria that make bees also have always been responsible for the handling of iron and selenium and all the other minerals. If you don't have the right guys, then even if you're not anemic, even if your iron levels in your blood are normal, you can have an iron deficiency in your brain. For instance, if you've had 2 other kids and they slept well and the 3rd kid is not sleeping well, it's very likely that somewhere along the way, your D went low. You gave all of these essential elements to those 2 babies, and your 3rd baby has been held in a situation where they are not receiving the same things that the 1st 2 did. And that baby may respond to iron supplementation. And it's, according to my other practitioner, very dramatic. Most of the time in adults, iron is a big player. It's not currently in the right sleep program as yet, because it's taken me about 3 years to become confident about putting that out for the general public. But I think the great majority of people who wind up looking for me because their sleep is wrong have iron deficiency and also a sulfur deficiency, both of which are probably really important in most parts of our brain functioning, and especially in sleep. The iron through lots of the neurotransmitters, the iron and the sulfur through every single mitochondria in our body.
Do you want to know how to lose weight without counting calories or needing to use restrictive diets? Turns out the answer is on Instagram. You might be interested to know that over 70% of our paying clients begin their journey with a weight loss goal. Most of them achieve this goal without fad diets and without calorie counting. And in the process, they also rewire their brains to stop craving sugar, and they stop their secret binge eating sessions without the need to use loads of willpower. Why does what we do work? Because the fat that you want to lose, it isn't just about the calories you're consuming. It's actually wild how differently we do things. We work on your mind and your body gets better. And I think more people need to know about how we can do this for you too, which is exactly why I'm back on Instagram as The Real Weight Loss Coach. If you want to know how to really drop the weight that's been holding you down, how to keep it off, and to stay healthy long into the future, then follow me on Instagram. The link to my profile is in the show notes below, or you can search for me on Instagram by typing in The Real Weight Loss Coach. Give me a follow and I'll chat to you in the comments and the DMs over there. One of the things that is continually a theme when I look at the past or look into diseases or scenarios that we've got in the modern world now is often that, as you know, many of the problems we have of today really didn't exist almost at all in the past. And they're sort of consequences of civilization or progressive societies that are, you know, removing themselves from nature. And through, I guess, you know, Yali and I have gone down a very alternative, maybe traditional path with a lot of the decisions that we've made in regards to, you know, health and birthing and pregnancy and all those things. And so I feel like what you're sharing, what I'm taking away, is that there's actually a lot of hope for parents that have got new babies that are really sleep deprived or they're waking up every hour, that it's actually just a mineral or a vitamin deficiency possibly that is at the root of that. Because, and maybe that's the reason that we're in a situation where he's sleeping quite well, because we're on top of the iron. We've been making sure of that for a while now. We're on top of vitamin D as well. And a bit of, you know, I'd love to give him more sort of nature exposure, but it's raining and cold at the minute. but for that biodiversity, you know, to produce B5 and make sure those things are coming through. But I feel like it's really hopeful, because instead of being told babies are just like this, it's like, oh no, it might not be perfect, but this is possibly a solvable problem to some degree in which everybody in the house isn't ruined all of the time.
Yes, I think this is very simple and easy conceptually to prevent. It mm-hmm. is extremely difficult to cure once you have an autistic kid who is having so much discomfort during the day and at night that they're constantly agitated. So if you're trying to observe that child's behavior, if they're nonverbal, so if you take the worst scenario where you have a nonverbal three-year-old, that's daunting, okay? You have to do all these experiments. You could prevent this so easily, and the literature is there. It's not me just thinking this stuff up. The literature is there and supports these ideas that the vitamin D level has to be measured, and that you can safely measure that in moms. And then you can change her supplement and then watch what happens to the kid if they're on breast milk. And those sorts of things are things that every single mom has available to her. The difficulty is that you have to step away from routine medicine and you have to be willing to experiment on your own with the most treasured, most valuable thing that's ever happened to you in your life. You're going to experiment on this infant? Are you mad? You know, I'm going to go to the best doctor on the planet. The best doctor on the planet told you that being out in the sun was bad for you. So we, as medicine with a capital M, is completely responsible for telling the whole globe, including people in Singapore that have dark skin. Like, what the hell are white male physicians who are dermatologists doing mucking around with the lifestyle of someone in a different part of the planet? I see all these guys that are doing, you know, mowing lawns in my neighborhood who are Latinos, and they all have hats and long sleeves on, and they're going to be fat, and they're going to have diabetes, and they're going to die 20 years sooner than they should. We as physicians are responsible for this, in my view, which is horrifying.
No. Yeah, it's that whole conversation around circadian biology, right, which has been sort of popularized in the last 5 years, and how our relationship to the sun affects our biorhythms. And I think it's good that these conversations are coming to the forefront, and that, you know, skin color, skin tone, position on the earth, UV exposure is part of the conversation, because I think medicine and people in general have been confused as to why, you know, for instance, in Australia, the last couple of decades of sunscreen marketing has led to the most enormous outburst of skin cancer ever. And there's a whole conversation about whether, you know, the sunscreens are actually toxic or not, and plenty of them are not ideal. But it starts to answer some of these questions of why are all these populations around the earth having these experiences when, you know, they're in better, wealthier countries. And obviously the food supply is a part of that conversation as well, and a few other things. But this circadian biology thing is super fascinating. But the thing that I wanted to ask that popped up before in regards to this fertility conversation, because you mentioned the way that it affects spermatogenesis in men. I'm curious, because men often get left out of the conversation when it comes to fertility. It's just sort of regarded, especially socially, as like the woman's failing if a pregnancy doesn't happen or isn't sustained. So I'm curious about how, I guess, the D, the sleep, the B5 affects the fertility, you know, of a particular couple from the male's perspective?
The first is, and these are all examples pulled from my own clinical experience. So the first is, if you're D deficient and your sleep is terrible, your testosterone is going to be low. It will eventually be low because testosterone is secreted in response to certain phases of sleep. That's the case with all the sex hormones. They're tied to what we're doing in our sleep. And I got into this really before I got into D because I had young males with daily headache who didn't sleep well. And I'm trying to figure out why. And somebody finds that their testosterone is low and they give them testosterone. They give an 18-year-old testosterone. That strikes me as bizarre. Okay.
Yeah.
And it turns out to be more and more common. And that person starts to sleep better. And then their headaches get better. Okay. And then it wears off because testosterone is just one piece of this big wheel. And it turns out that the D tells the pituitary. So it's the D has receptors in the pituitary to multiple different things. One, the thyroid releasing hormone. So D and thyroid are directly linked. That's so that when mama bear goes into the hibernate, her metabolic rate in all of her cells goes down. It allows you to hibernate. The second is all the sex hormone releasing hormones. So luteinizing hormone, follicle stimulating hormone, which are both the same in males, are tied to the D also. So you can look at it from one side, which was I already knew that some of my teenagers and early 20s males really I needed to look for testosterone levels. Well, why would their testosterone levels be low? Because they're sleeping badly. So what we found out first was, oh, they have sleep apnea. Oh, sleep apnea must cause them to have low testosterone. And oh, and it's true. If you put a CPAP device on somebody with apnea, their testosterone will go up a little bit, but it won't last because there's still something else that's not right in the background. I don't know what the hormonal link is in the same way that I do to the ovary because I haven't really gone down that path. But I was just doing research on the B5 side of it. That's about this B vitamin. And there just happened to be mouse experiments where they blocked the B5 and showed one of the things that they found was that there was no spermatogenesis. So the lines where they did that were not able to reproduce. That's assumed to be something similar in humans. I don't have any, because we have ignored B5, there are no experiments of those types. The experiments that I first fell into were from the 1950s. Those were very small studies with convicts who were actually tube-fed a blocker of B5. And what they got was a gait disorder, belly problems, insomnia, and burning in the hands and feet. They didn't measure their sperm count or anything like that. In the last 3 years, so I came out with an article reading about B5, talking about it in 2016. But at the time, I had no supporting literature to say, you know, we should just get over it and recognize that all the Bs are coming from the microbiome. And since so many of my clients and patients have irritable bowel, and the GI literature is now claiming that we all have the wrong microbiome for the wrong reason, they talk about the antibiotics. It's quite clear that somebody in the past knew that these eight were linked to one another. Because they named them all. And they actually came from a culture that they cultured with yeast and bacteria. So there's a biochemical reason why it came about. In the last 3 years, the surprising part to me is there are very important articles that have just started to be published. B5 deficiency in pigs that have a gait disorder. A guy in New Zealand, whose last name is Cooper, Garth Cooper, whose postdoc actually found that parts of the brain at autopsy were B5 deficient because every single article says there is no such thing as B5 deficiency. It is in every food. That it turns out to be a lie, which was very confusing to me as I got into this. But Garth Cooper's original article that shows that when they're looking at the cytoplasm, so they're doing studies on what's inside the cell, not the nucleus, but in the cytoplasm, and they're doing what's called metabolomics, find that certain parts of the brain that are known to be connected to memory in Alzheimer's disease are B5 deficient. And at the end of the article, and it was found by accident, which is really interesting. The end of the article, they say, we find this extremely confusing because every single other article says there is no B5 deficiency because it's in every food. And I'm like, me too. And now he has a series of articles that show that's the case in Parkinson's, that's the case in Alzheimer's, that's the case in Huntington's disease. He's actually gone to the next step, which is to say B5 is needed for coenzyme A. Coenzyme A is needed for the normal Krebs cycle. That means that the enzymes, so when we're taking these little pieces of someone's brain cell, the enzymes that are related to coenzyme A should be lower than they need to be. So there's great science that's actually rotating around B5 deficiency for the very first time. And that actually links back to the same question. It's very likely that both male and female will be similarly affected. The hardest part for all of this is we've been taught to say, what are the signs of vitamin D deficiency? What is the dose of vitamin D? If you don't catch the fact that it's quite complex and vitamin D deficiency is never really by itself, it will never hurt you. It's supposed to go up and down. It's when vitamin D deficiency over years leads to the wrong microbiome, then there's this huge cascade of many things that go deficient together. And then you have to say, well, what are the symptoms of having the wrong microbiome? Well, basically every disease that you see commonly now. Well, that's absurd, okay? Most doctors are going to say, that's ridiculous. But if you look at it in a different way, you could say, well, medicine only really addresses what walks in the door. You know, we go looking for answers for what walks in the door. There's no epidemic of a purple horn growing out of my forehead because it hasn't walked in the door. Okay. And then we want to put next to that, is anybody studying those 88-year-olds who've never been to the doctor because there's nothing wrong with them? Mm. Are they studying that? No, of course not. Because we only study the sick people. That means what you and I want is to be able to go back to being, I don't need the doctor. That takes a really big change in how the lens you look through. So that the lens you should be looking through is, if all the other animals on the planet just wind up here, the squirrels out there just have their babies, and if my dogs don't kill them or they don't get run over, they could potentially live for 20 years in captivity. I mean, I'm sure they have diseases, but they don't go to GNC or any other supplement store. They just, not only that, you know what's really interesting? They just eat what tastes good to them, which is another really weird thing. When we're focusing on this diet, for the very first time in the last 2 months or so, I was like, wait, does that mean that the bugs live inside us are really going up and manipulating my mouth and my nose so that I eat things that they want? And there are really good articles that suggest that's probably true. Who lives inside you determines what tastes good to you.
Yeah, there's some great research by Fred Provenza on nutritional wisdom that's worth checking out. But he did some studies on goats and sheep and then later a bit on humans of just determining whether animals have this natural craving for something they're deficient in. And basically the determination was that was true in all the animals he studied and children before we'd gotten into their heads, basically. And adults basically had no idea how to intuitively move towards foods that solved their nutritional deficiencies because the food landscape has like messed this all up, basically.
That's a beautiful comment. So let me add just a couple of other things that are kind of to the side that are about before pregnancy, that, for instance, if you've had endometriosis, you're more likely to have infertility. If you've had polycystic ovarian disease, you're more likely to have infertility. Both of those diseases are really caused by low D. That's all. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to do with the microbiome. It's just basically, if you get your D above 40, there's a cascade of events that causes endometriosis. But D has receptors in the fallopian tube. So keep in mind that the uterus itself, when it sloughs its lining, gravity is the only way that the lining knows to go out the cervix down the bottom. But the fallopian tubes are wide open. they can actually shoot endometrial tissue up into the lining of the peritoneum around the abdominal tissue. That means that there are D receptors in the fallopian tubes that probably affect the direction of beating of the cilia that line the fallopian tubes. Because humans are very unique for mammals in that they get fertilized right in the mid portion of the fallopian tube. Most mammals get fertilization in the uterus, but that kind of implies that we need cilia that are beating up from the uterus up into the mid portion of the fallopian tube that help the sperm go up. We have cilia that are beating down that help the egg come down. And then there's fertilization. Then there's a bunch of chemicals released that are going to affect what happens to the fallopian tube. Then the fertilized egg comes down into the uterus and implants. If you do not have the right amount of D, this is a hypothesis on my part because I haven't found the articles about which way the cilia are beating, but we know that the cilia are there. If you don't have the right D, then you don't have that additional help to make sure that your endometrial tissue goes in the right place. Then the second thing is once it goes into the peritoneal cavity, your immune system is run by D. It is a heavy part of how the immune system works normally. And when that is too low, the immune system, the macrophages that are supposed to crawl along in your peritoneum and find those endometrial implants and kill them and get rid of them, that the part doesn't exist. The polycystic ovarian syndrome is just a description of an ovary that has multiple eggs that are all being suppressed. They're all making a cyst. They're trying to ovulate, but they don't do that. That means anybody who's trying to get pregnant, who's had either one of those, they can fix those. They are not permanent. They are there because the physicians have not paid attention to the written literature. It exists there. It's in the OBGYN literature. It's not hard to find. You just have to kind of open your mind and say, oh, a vitamin, that word vitamin doesn't scare me or make me feel like I'm less than.
Yeah, there's so much in this conversation we've had today that is just going to be so beneficial to a lot of people. And that it is, like, I'm glad we're having this discussion because I think just like all the discussions we've had, a lot of what you've got to share is things that people are not being told by their doctor or their health practitioners. And in this time, and you know, honestly, we're surrounded by friends that have fertility issues, to be totally honest. And then we come along and we're like, oh, oops, accidentally, the health nuts of the group accidentally had a baby much sooner than they planned to.
That's the way it used to be all the time. Most people who got married, it was because, they have a baby who's born at 8 months. A miracle. That's an 8-pound baby born at 8 months. Who's ever even heard of that?
But for anybody listening that wants to hear more of you, if they, you know, want to get into your world, get some of your support, where do they find you on the internet?
I have a website, ergomanak.com, but I also have a YouTube channel now that has many little tiny videos. So I have big interviews like this that go anywhere from half an hour to 3 hours, where I try to describe what happened to me and my patients. And that's a little hard to get your head around that. So if you want to just get your toes wet, then just go and read the sleep chats or watch the sleep chats on YouTube. My YouTube channel is at Dr. Stasha Gomanak. And if you just put in vitamin D and Gomanak or Gomaphalagy or something like that, usually my YouTube channel will pop up. And the more that you read or listen to, the more likely you are to say, oh, well, that happened to me. It's not necessarily just about sleep. There's so many illnesses that are claimed to be chronic and irreversible that really aren't. They are reversible by having much better sleep. And since we have left sleep for last, we haven't been treating the sleep at the same time we've been using our medicine.
I'll put those links down below so that anyone can scroll down and click the link and jump into your world. And I guess I've asked you this question a few times now, so maybe in the context of today's conversation, what is one piece of health information you wish more people knew about?
The most important one right now is for all the people who started vitamin D during COVID. Because the reason why I have a website is I started with vitamin D. Vitamin D made our sleep better. It wasn't perfect, but it was better. And then at 2 years, we all got much worse. and we had an array of things. Many people had generalized joint pain. Lots of people had burning in their hands and feet. Everybody's sleep got worse again. Taking D without bringing back the microbiome pushes the body to make or repairs. And if your microbiome isn't right, even if you don't know it, you will become deficient in multiple things, including the B vitamins. So I see multiple people now who have terrible things where they say, I took D. My D is 60, Stasha. I mean, I've already done your program. Well, let's go back and talk about when that burning started in your feet. When did you start to have hand and foot pain? And when did you go back to not sleeping again? Because you got a little bit better, but it was 4 years ago in the middle of COVID when you stayed in your house all the time. So there's a big message, which is it's not directly due to D. It's that D causes this secondary deficiency state that's linked to the microbiome. So doing D plus B50 for 3 months is really important. And understanding why you're doing that and what to look for and how to use that for the rest of your life is really what my Right Sleep program is about.
Fantastic. Well, thanks for being here today. And thanks for sharing all of your wisdom. And no doubt we'll get you back on the show at some point soon.
Okay. Happy to come back.
Thanks, Stasha. We'll see you soon.
Thank you. Thanks, Maddie.
Hey, thanks for listening to the show. If you enjoyed this episode or learned anything at all, the gift of your 5-star rating would be incredibly helpful. And what's even more powerful is if you write a review. You can do it below each episode on Spotify, every time an episode comes out, and inside Apple Podcast, simply find the main page of the show with all the episodes on it, scroll to the bottom, hit write a review, share your amazing feedback, and then hit send. It helps this show grow tremendously and allows me to successfully invite bigger and more famous guests each time we do the show. Thank you, thank you, thank you for helping us climb the charts, climb the algorithm, and help more people. Oh, and by the way, I have a short disclaimer as well. I just wanted to quickly remind you that the information provided on this podcast is for general informational purposes only. While we strive to bring you accurate and up-to-date content, it's important to note that a lot of this is mixed with opinions, stories, and ideas not supported by mainstream science or medicine. Any advice or suggestions should not be considered a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always consult a healthcare provider before making any decisions about the health and wellness of you and your family. Remember too that what works for one person may not work for another. And just as we promote on the show, each person is responsible for their own health decisions. Thank you for tuning into the How to Not Get Sick and Die podcast. And now, the next episode. Here it is.